times. Now we're going to need to think entirely differently if we're going to live to be 150, 200 years old. And this is because, obviously, it makes no sense to live to be 150 if you're going to spend the last 60 years of your life in a mental institution with dementia. Right. I now have to think about the impact of taking that C60 or other life extension approaches on my thinking. How should I be changing my thinking to accommodate this new me in this newer, longer reality? We're all going to basically have to educate ourselves far more than any doctor ever has. Most of that education is probably going to be focused on nutrition, supplementation, deficiencies, and so on and so on. Is that you want to get better while you're able to and overcome the limitations that have been imposed on us prior to developing the far look.
There are three daily habits that are destroying your memories, and you will lose 10% of your brain by the age of 55 and 20% of your brain by the age of 75. It'll actually shrink if you do not do something about this. There is a free workshop that you can partake in where you'll learn what these three habits are, how to fix it, and how to regain your memories. There's a link below in the description on how to sign up. Be sure to sign up. It's free information.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. I have Cliff High back today, and I gotta tell you, I have so much fun when I talk to Cliff. And he's going through this renewal process, rethinking what he wants to do in the future. And he's thinking about living longer and wanting a different career. And so we talk about what he's going through, what he's thinking, how C60, the longevity of C60 and other advances in science is gonna cause a longer life for many people, and what that means to individuals and to society. Just a fascinating discussion. I told him, I just want you to come back on. You know, my show is about disruption, innovation, big issues, but on the edge of where we're at. You know, when it comes to science and that, the edge and the big issues, which also affects the edge of what's going on, the change. And so come on and let's discuss some of that. And so I let him take the direction on this. Very fascinating. And then he sticks around for my patrons, and we talk about the advanced physics that's going on in Russia and how they're easily 40 to 60 years ahead of us and what that means and why and where we are in the United States. It was only supposed to be a short Patreon thing for about 20 minutes, turned into a whole episode. So we couldn't stop talking. It just got so fascinating. So that will be for my Patreons, and possibly later I'll put it up as a regular episode. But at this point, it's for my Patreons. You can see it for as little as a dollar a month, and very fascinating. So that's up there. The link is below. And let's get into this really fun conversation with Cliff High. Cliff, welcome back to the show.
Hello, Sarah. Thank you very much. It's very nice being here and chatting with you.
Well, I always have a blast when you come on, and I've had a lot of people going, when is Cliff coming back? And so, well, you're here, so I'm really glad that you are.
Yeah. And I'm very pleased as well, because I've been looking for venues to try and get across an idea. So the people will basically leave me alone. So the trolls will just leave me alone for a while. So there won't be that much in the way of demands so that I can get some stuff done that I need to do.
Yeah. And, well, the trolls are a problem for everyone right now, right?
Yes. Yes. They're very, very agitated and irritated. And, you know, it's the cosmic rays or something. Who knows? But indeed it is. It's extremely aggravating. Go ahead.
I was going to say, we were going to chat about, and why don't you tell me what you want to chat about? Because I have some questions for you, but go ahead, because you had an idea on how you wanted to start this. So take it.
Sure. Sure. What I wanted to talk about was the way that we need to think, and the reason we need to think in a different manner about ourselves, the ever-present now, and the future. And this is especially true for those people that are taking C60 or other approaches to living into that future. And the reason that we need to do this is because We have been genetically tuned, so to speak, and historically tuned to think in a particular kind of maturation process that begins at age zero and ends at approximately age 70s or 80s. Now we're going to need to think entirely differently if we're going to live to be 150, 200 years old. And this is because, obviously, it makes no sense to live to be 150 if you're going to spend the last 60 years of your life in a mental institution with dementia, right? That kind of thing. And so certain avenues of thinking present themselves when you look at the larger picture. And you can look at the larger picture and say, I'm taking C60 in order to improve my odds or increase my life space into which I will have a lifespan and make that life space as long as possible. Because I'm doing this, I now have to think about the impact of taking that C60 or other life extension approaches on my thinking. How should I be changing my thinking to accommodate this new me in this newer, longer reality? And so there's a lot of thinking about it that needs to change. We can't, in my opinion, this almost all of this stuff here is my opinion, we can't go bumbling through the way we have in the past. You know, getting up in the morning and you know, doing your usual bacon, toast, and eggs breakfast, that kind of thing. All of these things need to be examined with the idea that you've got another, you're 60 years old, but you've got another 100 years potentially that you're going to be doing things. And so you want to be, in my opinion, the way to look at this is that we want to craft a strategy. And the name of that strategy is die very young and healthy at an advanced age.
Yeah. So okay. You feel great old.
All the way up, right.
And that's what Dr. Bill Anders keeps saying about lengthening our telomeres. The idea is to feel great when you die.
Correct. That, I agree 100%. But in order to achieve that, especially if we're adding a number of years, we need to alter everything we're doing in this present now so as not to cause problems 20 years out, 30 years out, etc. And so from my advanced age now, at 64, I'm aware that since about 1958, or 68, sorry, since about 1968, the pathway I have been on relative to the environment around me, the food body, those things I can eat, those things that are delivered by the social order for me to eat, has radically altered, and it has altered my relationship with it. So in other words, glutens as they existed, lectins as they existed pre-1968 are no longer at that stage. Now, for instance, in 1968, gluten was not an additive to food. These days, they grow wheat with the express purpose of just extracting the gluten as a food additive, and they put it into all kinds of weird stuff. So for the other day, I happened to pick up a seafood salad. And what is in the seafood salad as an additive but wheat gluten? And so it's like, okay, you know, this
sugar, I bet you.
Probably. I didn't even get that far.
I saw the wheat gluten and put it back. Everything.
Exactly. Yeah. See, so we now have to think about these things. Why do we have to think about them? Well, if you're not gluten intolerant now, it's an issue of use or abuse, so to speak, right? That so as you age, everybody's going to become gluten intolerant, especially the longer you live, because glutens are not intended for us to be digesting all the plant lectins and so on. So prior to the last ice age, our diet was radically different. As humanity's diet was radically different. The last ice age hits, and all of the big mammals that we had counted on for a major part of our food supply, they die off. And so we're left to scramble around. And so in the last ice age, we adopt the eating of grains, which pack in a lot of glucose, basically, and other carbohydrates, for bulking us up for the ice and the cold that we have to deal with. So it got us through the ice age. The problem is that it was never really our intended food source. Prior to that ice age, humans didn't eat grain, and most of the animals we ate did not eat grain. And as a result of which, we had very little exposure to this class of proteins that we call lectins. And of the lectins, gluten is one of them. Gluten is this giant molecule relative to many of the other lectins. And what gluten does is it's all interrelated to a whole slew of conditions. So unfortunately, in my opinion, in order to die young at a very advanced age in a fit body, doing things and happy, we're all going to basically have to educate ourselves far more than any doctor ever has. Most of that education is probably going to be focused on nutrition, supplementation, deficiencies, and so on and so on. So one of the things we can do is we can go to the World Health Organization right now and drill into their data that they present free of charge, and you discover some fantastic things. You have to get down below this layer of political bullshit that they put up there, and you get down into the actual data, and you find out that researchers are pretty convinced that 98% of Americans are deficient to a degree that it affects their bodies in iodine. Now, this was never a condition that existed pre-ice age, okay, because the oceans are evenly filled. They're just absolutely saturated with iodine. A lot of the stuff we ate prior to then was coming from the oceans. We'd pick up the iodine, we'd be okay. But now that's not the case. And so we're mineral deficient in a number of different areas, some of them very key minerals. Like iodine is used to support the autoimmune system at various different kinds of levels, but it's in every single cell. And so we're going to have to make sure we get these kind of things. We're going to have to examine what does my body need and figure out ways to ascertain that, to answer that question. And then we're going to have to figure out ways to get it.
Well, do you think that every body is going to be different because we have different chemistry, a little slightly different? So we'll almost have digital monitors of what we need in our body, and then that will help us understand what we need to eat.
That would be okay, but I don't want to get too far off.
Well, but don't you think the whole...
No, I think you're correct. I'm just saying that we have to be aware of some things. For instance, there's 7,000 years ago when Ayurvedic medicine was resurrected from the remnants of the Ice Age civilization. And they brought that and traditional Chinese medicine out. They went into body type information. So there's the Kapha, Pitta, Vata body types within Hindu, and then within each of those, there are variations. And then there's also blends. But what I was objecting to was the digital. Here's the problem. Most people don't understand this, and this is why it's really stupid to ever gamble against a software. But computers are not able to represent all numbers in a digital format. I wrote this big article in 83 in three parts. That was published on SQL Server around ghosting data. And a lot of it had to do with a weird kind of it's not a buffer overflow or a stack overflow, it's a misrepresentation. But there's a lot of numbers that you cannot represent digitally with zeros and ones. They're just like gaps in between. It's kind of like trying to, in a crude way for everybody to understand, it's very much like trying to represent a square root of 5 as an absolute digit. Okay, so the computers would have it be an absolute digit rigid within these parameters. And it's never, ever going to be that way. And there's reasons to suspect that the part you're excluding is going to be valuable. So I would say that digital is going to be helpful, but I'm not going to rely on it 100% because there's things it's going to miss. And it's going to be related to how well it's programmed as well. But you're basically correct. We need to monitor ourselves. I don't know that we need to do it every minute or any of that kind of thing, because we're looking at what I call the far look, okay, the long view. So I want to be, 120 years old. I want to be in better shape than I am now. That's part of the die young at an advanced age strategy, is that you want to get better while you're able to, and overcome the limitations that have been imposed on us prior to developing the far look.
That makes sense. And don't you think that, because right now we are bombarded with food that's a certain way, and it's everywhere. And so if we can get everywhere things that help us and assist us, then it's just not so hard.
It's going to be rough, though, for probably 40 years, 40 or 50 years. So the real big change started in 68 in our food system, insofar as I've been able to ascertain via research. That was when major agribusiness was able to get enough legislative power behind them that they were able to start doing things, and things started changing to the worse. So it'll be 40 years before we have a supportive system, and it'll constantly be evolving and changing and new ideas popping up and all this sort of thing. So I don't think we'll ever get to any kind of a utopia or a nirvana sort of a state in that regard.
So you have your allergies, so everybody knows why he's sitting there rubbing his eyes and stuff, and it's just at its peak right now.
Right. And it's a bunch of grasses off the beach. The winds are blowing it right up here, is my supposition. And I had to take the dogs down for their walk on the beach, so I'm really exposed to it. Yeah.
So, but what do you think about living longer? You know, we have to deal with ourselves personally and take responsibility for ourselves. But at what point do we look at the bigger picture and say, well, how is society going to handle this?
Well, there's the rub. Okay, we can look at that, we can examine it, we can speculate it, but in my opinion, none of our speculations, none of our thinking about it is going to end up being actionable in the sense that we won't be able to control the outcome, right? We're one of 7 billion people on this planet, so the most we can do is to push the people around us to do something and hope that that ripples out in a far enough way that there might be some other change. And we can provide things like this show. We can provide strategies for thinking about the future that will guide rational beings away from some of the hiccups we're going to run into anyway, and have a tendency to be a harmonizing and calming effect as we go forward in the future. So in my way of thinking, I don't want to live in a Mad Max world. So I want to contribute to the success of the society around me in the larger social order globally as much as I'm able. And I want to do that by adding real value that will come back to me, not in the form of necessarily a monetary reward from universe, but would come back to me in the sense of a reward for universe for adding that value. And that would be healthier, happier people living around me, less social strife, more positive attitude in which to live, more harmonious approach to, you know, to the stars and beyond, that kind of thing, right?
And becoming more aware of who you are, so you don't need your own ego and all your own selfishness isn't the sole purpose of why you're here. And you start evolving mentally to see it more as, how do I make the universe around me a peaceful, great place to be?
Right. Let's take the word make out of there and put harmonize in instead.
Okay, we don't make force. Universe.
We don't make universe do shit. Right. The universe does as it wills, not as we would command.
Well, you can't swim upstream, right? You want to swim with the stream and try to guide it in a way that's productive.
Yeah. There you go. And to harmonize with all of this, it takes a different approach now to thinking about that in the long term. And so, but we have to recognize that as humans, we're going to be going through a transition, and then humanity is going to go through a transition. That transition is being impacted and created and happening as each and every person decides, oh, I'm going to try this weird C60 stuff. You know, every single person that adds into that, they're going to tell other people if they've had positive benefits or negative benefits, it won't matter. But it gets the idea out there and it ripples and starts expanding. And so over time, the entire social order and all of humanity is going to change. Since that is occurring, in my opinion, we need to think about our participation. And I'm not trying to be anything other than practical. So I'm not trying to suggest a moralistic approach or any of that. I want to be practical. And the reason I state that is because practicality, in my opinion, and an engineering approach to it, in my opinion, yields results that are harmonious and beneficial. Whereas I've seen a lot of morality go absolutely really wonky and cause all kinds of bad things, right? So it was quite moral for the Catholic Church to kill a third of all women in southern Germany because they were morally correct in their opinion that they needed to eliminate witches. But they killed so many women in the German Inquisition that whole villages were left without a single female around above the age of about six. And so that was a very negative, unpractical approach to dealing with their problems.
Well, right? It was morally from their perspective, but they didn't understand that their their interpretation of witch was a little skewed.
We don't know what they understood, okay? And that's
true, I guess.
Okay, and indeed it was moral from their perspective, but there is no other form of morality other than the personal perspective. There's no other form of morality. Universe never tells us what is good or bad from a moral viewpoint. It says, you know, it allows you to find out what works and what does not work. And you have to understand and this goes back to Cozy Rev. Okay, so Cozy Rev, as a scientist, was put into a gulag. He was the best astrophysicist on the planet, had invented all kinds of stuff, discovered all kinds of stuff, and yet he ended up in a gulag in the Soviet system. He survived the gulag, clearing land, draining swamps, taking down forests in Siberia on an inadequate diet and so on. And he comes out, and he didn't reject his society, but he discovered that his ability to participate in it as a scientist was gone because he'd been in the gulag for so long that the science had left him by. And so he goes off into this little backwater and he discovered some really significant stuff. That time, when it manifests, if we wanted to think about time manifesting through a slew of entropy, time is continually manifesting in either left-hand spins or right-hand spins. And there's differences to how those manifestations occur in terms of the impact on the time as it develops and the events that flow from all of that. And so we can get down to the level where we can say that universe is providing us a series of feedback mechanisms that allow us to guide ourselves through universe. And in my opinion, the smart person discovers at some point that it's more practical, more easy to be harmonious with other fellow travelers that are also going in the same direction. And and in that sense, you harmonize and you add value in a combinoric fashion to what universe is provided. So this is kind of like the social media effect, right? It's one thing for one guy to have an idea, but it's something else for that guy to get out online with a really good idea and get a million people in the local humanity talking about it. The impact at an energy level within that population of humanity is going to be radically different. And yet it's all words.
Well, what do you think about the influence of ethics versus religion as we start to age?
I think ethics have a value beyond a practical value beyond the prima facie case of the ethical system one adopts. So in other words, I think the mere adoption of an ethical system transfers value to me because it gives me a discipline in which to live that A, frees my mind from worrying about things that are outside that discipline. And unlike religion, it does so without externally imposed constraints and enforcements. Okay, so, but you have to be careful about it, right? Because humans are as they are, they need to react in different ways. They need the ability to not be rigid all the time. There's always backsliding, there's always deviation, checking out new things, and so on, in order that we don't go crazy with it. But most ethical systems, like Stoicism is one that, or Taoism, these are ethical systems. They're not religions. arguably, yoga is not is an ethical system and not a religion in any way, shape, or form. And so they're very, very valuable because they provide you lifelong guidance. And I can quite clearly tell you that without something greater than yourself, you will flounder in your 50s. And so what would be that impact if you were in your hundreds without that guidance of that discipline or that ethical system? So I think they're extremely valuable, regardless of what weird-ass ethical system one may adopt.
Well, don't you think as you age, that becomes more and more important, something beyond yourself, that you're saying once you get to your 50s? Yeah. Now, my understanding with ethics is, you know, I've taught ethics, is everybody has their own ethical system, framework, ethical framework, which evolves over time. Every time you run into something that doesn't fit your framework, and it's like, oh, this doesn't quite work in my framework, you evolve your framework. It's a lifetime effort of creating your ethical framework based on all of your experiences and trying to make it work with the foundational things of ethics, understanding of ethics. Does that
and
make
I
sense?
Agree 100, I agree 100%, and that's the key difference between ethics and religion. Religion doesn't evolve.
Yeah, it's
rigid.
It's rigid, and it was. I think some of it was written to evolve with the current cultural times, but I don't think that people understand that, right?
I agree, but yes. Basically, yes. Religions are by definition cults that survive the death of the founder. Okay, that's actually really truly the ultimate definition of a sociological basis for religion. And you get into weird situations where ethical systems start off, an ethical approach to something seems really good, and then in the end it becomes a religion, like Henry Ford's attempt to grow rubber in Central America. I can't think of the name of the place, but you know about this historically, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. He had all those acreages cleared. He had an ethical structure built for the workers. They had housing, they had stores, they had sanitation, they had clean environment, everything. Of course, he was doing it wrong. He was planting his rubber trees far too close. Nobody understood about rubber at all, so it was doomed to fail at that level. But what killed his effort was that his ethical commitment to treating these people well became a rigid structure in the hands of the middle management, and they wouldn't deviate. And so all these people had certain bedtimes they had to go to when it was really a guideline. You know, you're going to do better if you get a little bit more sleep, guy, and don't party until midnight and then expect to go work on the rubber plantation starting at 6 in the morning. That was kind of the idea. Instead, it was like everybody shall go to bed at 8 p.m. Well, you know, there was no latitude for variation among humans. And so as a result, it only took a little bit of time. And then all the workers rebelled, burned everything down, chased off all of the Henry Ford's work managers. And they went back to the life that they'd had prior to the ethics hitting the jungle. So, you know, it was ethical. His approach was personally moral to him. It was also socially moral and socially acceptable at the time, and doomed to failure because it became rigid in the hands of the middle management that wouldn't allow change or evolution, you know, and so on. Now, was that, I don't know any of the circumstances. I don't know how close he managed that in terms of, did he tell these people, no, you've got to force them to go to bed at 8 at night or whatever the deal was. You know, I just don't know how it went. But the thing is, the ethics, the discipline allow you to have that far look. Okay, if you don't have that framework for your thinking, then you're constantly moving from reaction to reaction to reaction to reaction of whatever's going on in the momentary now. And you need to do that. You need to be aware of the momentary now, because this is the only time we have the ability to do anything, is within this moment, the next moment, and so on. I can't do anything 20 years out. I can't do anything 20 years back. You know, one has yet to manifest. The other is already locked up into the concretion of the past. And there we go. But I can alter my thinking now such that 20 years out, the individual that I will be able to take appropriate decisions within that time. And I need not try and constrain myself 20 years out. In other words, I can have an ethical system that says, you know, you treat every being the way that it needs to be treated and just let it go at that. And then 20 years out, when I meet that strange beast from, you know, the Fangor Nebula, and I've got to deal with it, I will be able to deal with it on its terms in my reality of that moment without trying to be in any kind of a rigid mental state that might be injurious, right?
It's really tricky. It is. Yeah. So what do you think about, you know, people that push back and say there's going to be too many people if we live this long?
That's bullshit. I can say that right now, let's go back to the Jain religion. Okay. The Jain are a very interesting religion, about 25 to 30 million of them in India, concentrating in doctors, accounting, high tech, that sort of thing. They have a formless God, a God without a beingness, okay, without a corporeality. But these individuals have an incredible cosmology that goes back through Sanskrit that predates what we think of as modern day Hinduism. So the Jain, in that sense, is their literature is at least older than the modern day Hindu religions. And what they show in their cosmology is that humanity, at the time that this particular cosmology was codified, was written up as being ensconced on 2.5 islands of life in our solar system. These 2.5 islands were Earth, Mars, and the Moon. Humanity at that time was 600 billion people. 600
Wow.
billion people. Not merely seven, right? So, and these numbers are not, you know, okay, people need to understand that Hindus and the Jain among them are mathematicians. These people don't screw around with numbers. This was not a guesstimate. This was not an exaggeration through linguistics being carried over time. This was a precise set of numerical recordings. And they even record that this last number, prior to all of this stuff going on that caused the disruption here on Earth, at the time that cosmology was codified, that number was a result of a census.
So there's
a lot of room out there, right? And you know the old thing about stand on Zanzibar, right? You know the island of Zanzibar?
No, tell me about this.
Okay, it's a title of a book. And the idea is that at the time the book was written with, I think there were about 3 billion people on the planet. Everybody on the planet could stand on the island of Zanzibar. The entire population of the world could be put onto the island of Zanzibar, and we would all have one square yard in which to stand on. Okay, right now, all of humanity can be put into the state of Texas, and we'd all have several acres.
Yeah.
And so there'd be no humans anywhere else. So we got a lot of space. You know, here's something else. Half of 50% of all of the arable, growable land on Earth has never had a human footprint on it.
Wow, that's pretty incredible. Well, and do you think that it's also tied back to the fact that we don't all have to have beef? We don't all have to have, our food system takes up so many resources, but we're eating in ways that aren't necessarily growing cattle takes up a lot of resources.
Yeah. and see, there's the thing. I mean, we've got to get into the whole food issue in terms of, as a social order, we've got to really look at this. But here's something that we'll discover, and that we'll discover that the mechanisms that have them growing the cattle the way they are now may die of their own accord. So imagine a situation where 1968, we change and all of a sudden we're taking gluten out of wheat and adding it to other products. After a while, we're adding all kinds of gluten to animal products because it fattens the animals up, chickens, cows, etc. Gluten is a very large lectin, a very large protein. But at some point, after generations of these chickens and cows, the chickens and cows become saturated with the lectins. It goes into their flesh as opposed to being digested and changed. And so those lectins, that gluten, gets passed on to us in the flesh of the animal. And so you're going to become gluten sensitized whether you ever eat bread or not, simply because if you're consuming commercially produced flesh foods, you're going to get the lectins through that way. And so at some point, right now, the National Institute of Health has an estimate that within the United States, between 40 and 60%, depending on which of these two studies you looked at, it was either 40 to 60% or it was a 30 to 50%. So not much difference. Of all of the people in the United States have non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. Okay, so basically about half of us have this. Well, there's a correlation that they're able to key in on now between non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, and IBS, irritable bowel syndrome. And both of these are triggered in their understanding by the intake of gluten. Okay, and so I know this for a fact at a personal level. I've run across this. My body has adapted over these years. And I was a vegetarian for 35 years because I could not handle, having come back from Europe, I couldn't handle the diet here in America. And so I got very sick in the early 80s and decided the way to deal with it was to eliminate the high-fat animal kind of diet, you know, that we had here. And it calmed my liver down for a number of years, but it basically just delayed things. And because it was probably much more of a gluten sensitivity developing at that stage than an inability to deal with the fat from a liver viewpoint, right? And a gallbladder viewpoint. And it was just, and so it's all interrelated. And so there probably is no difference between irritable bowel syndrome, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, and gluten intolerance. And they all lead to other kinds of intolerances. And so once you discover that you're gluten intolerant, you're also going to discover you're lactose intolerant, and there's a whole lot of other lectins in other plants. So I noticed over time, even as a vegetarian, I could not eat green peppers unless they were exceptionally ripe. And the only ones I could eat were in this one particular restaurant up in, when I was working for Microsoft, up in Redmond, and they did the thing where they blackened them and took the skin off. And so now, now I understand the lectins are concentrated in the skin and the seeds. So eating the pulp is no big deal. And so that's why in Italy, when they deal with tomatoes, they only provide you with the pulp. You don't get seeds in a tomato sauce and you don't get skin. You don't get the lectins in Italian tomato sauce is basically what it amounts to. And it is the sensitization of your gut system over time that makes you develop this autoimmune response to the lectins. And basically, you're being poisoned. Okay, an example of a poison that could kill you would be ricin. And very few, one little tiny grain, one little tiny lectin of the castor bean lectin ricin will kill you dead. And so lectins can be quite fatal, whether it's instant or whether it's drug out over time. And so it gets to be this really complicated sort of a stew that we've got to think about, because there's no use trying to eat or think you're going to be eating, you know, pepperoni pizza and all of this kind of thing if you're going to be with this far look into the future. Because the longer you live, the greater the odds rise that your non-alcoholic fatty liver disease will manifest in the form of some form of an intolerance, gluten, lactose, or whatever.